Hi, welcome to At Any Rate, J.P. Morgan's Global Research Podcast. I'm Tom Salopek from Cross Asset Strategy. I'm joined by Phoebe White, Senior Rate Strategist and Head of U.S. Inflation Strategy, as well as Greg Shearer, Head of Metal Strategy. Hi, all. Welcome to the program. We're talking today about the recent CPI print, what it means for interest rates, real rates, and as well, how that feeds into the gold view, with gold having had a very strong run. Let's hear from Phoebe first. Phoebe, just want to hear your reaction to the recent CPI print and what it means for takeaways for the rate cutting at the end of this year. As you know, we started the year assuming that the Jan-Feb prints were hot prints, in large part due to seasonality. That seasonality would fade. And now, since then, we've had a very strong jobs numbers and strong CPI, and of course the real shocker was the super core. So what does this mean for you, your reaction to CPI and the rate cutting trajectory?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So I think, you know, three upside surprises on core CPI. It makes it harder to dismiss those earlier readings as something to do with seasonality or that, you know, bump on the road down to 2%. I think also you look at the details of the report and the fact that a lot of the strength has been broad-based across core services in conjunction with the strong labor market data, I think does make us a little bit more worried here. You know, it'll be interesting to hear how Fed speakers come out and talk about this data. But I think certainly some reasons to be a bit more concerned here. On the flip side, though, I think there are still some reasons to be fairly optimistic and, you know, not throw our models away completely. So for one, we still think that rent inflation should be moving lower over time. I think there's not a lot of strong fundamental reason why the official measures of rent inflation should run so much firmer than market-based measures of rent inflation. So we think that moderation is coming over time. There is some uncertainty around the timing, of course. Separately, you look at the sort of super core components, right? Core services, excluding rents, a lot of strength there in March once again, but a lot of the strength came in things like medical care services, auto insurance, components that are measured differently in the Fed's preferred measure, PCE. So we are tracking 0.27 month on month for March in core PCE. That would allow the year ago reading to tick down from 2.8 to 2.7. So, you know, taking a big step back, you know, things generally look consistent with progress. And then the last thing I'd mention is, you know, in Powell's sort of narrative and characterization of the inflation trend, he has highlighted the fact that labor markets are coming back into better balance, focusing on things like the JOLTS report, the fact that openings have come down, quits rates, and with that wage inflation gradually moving lower. So I think this puts a lot of focus on upcoming wage inflation data. You know, we do have the next ECI report out in a couple of weeks, and I think there's going to be a lot of focus on that. So generally, you know, you think of sort of all of those different pieces. I think the message from the Fed probably should be, you know, one still of patience, and that we'll need to see more data to sort of add conviction that the disinflation trend is still in train. We do have four CPI reports before the July FOMC meeting, and our forecast is still that by that time, the Fed should be in a place to cut. And we still have three cuts in our baseline forecast for this year.
Yeah, when I think about the transition from last year to this year, last year was kind of like good news is good news because the disinflation showed up in the second half of the year and kind of many different assets were celebrating the fall in inflation. And this year, it's been bad news is good news in the sense that the month-to-month, three-month changes in inflation have been the wrong way around. But at the same time, when you call it bumps in the road, you have the feeling the Fed's got your back. But arguably, you have these markets that have been a little bit too reliant on assuming a Fed's dovish reaction function, and you see a kind of first meaningful upticks in the VIX. I mean, previously, when the VIX would go up, it would go up and come right back down. And now it's kind of looks like we have some upside here and a bit more challenge on the stock versus bond risk premium front. But let's hear more from Phoebe about her views on tips, break-evens, and generally speaking, the overall duration view.
Sure. So you look at the rates market, obviously a very big reaction to the print yesterday and even, you know, since late last week, since before the payrolls report. So we've now sharply repriced the Fed. We're only pricing right around 40 basis points of easing for this year. So about a cut and a half. And we saw, you know, 2-year yields jumping 25 basis points yesterday. So it's been a big move. But, you know, you look at kind of where we were coming into the year, arguably, you know, markets really had gotten ahead of themselves at the start of the year when we were pricing, you know, around seven cuts for the year. And here we are pricing just 1.5. So I think it's possible the pendulum has sort of swung a bit too far in the other direction at this point. You look at 10-year yields at these levels, and they appear about 30 basis points too high versus our fair value framework. So we think that, you know, the move may be a little bit overdone at this point. We are cognizant that, you know, there aren't any sort of real catalysts the next couple of weeks to sort of shift the narrative in the other direction to bring easing sort of forward again, or for to get markets to price in more easing. So I think near term, I think there is a risk that we start to that we could move a little bit further. But generally, we, you know, again, still look for 3 cuts this year. We still think that over time, yields should be moving lower, and we maintain our year-end 10-year yield forecast at 4%. In terms of sort of strategy here, you know, we have liked holding on to positions that offer better carry and sort of more asymmetric upside than getting outright long duration. So one way to do that is in yield curve steepeners. So we've been recommending 5s/30s yield curve steepeners. And I think that's actually an attractive trade still in this environment, because it works well not only in kind of the bull steepening approaching the Fed cut regime, but also if we start to move more into a bear steepening regime, if markets start to question how high is our star, you know, clearly with the sort of serial revisions upward in growth forecasts, and the question of who will buy, you know, all the treasury supply that's still set to come this year. So if we start to see those kinds of things reasserting themselves, pushing term premium higher at the back end, we could still see that 5s/30 steepener trade working well. So we like holding on to that. And the other trade we like is being long in 5-year tips. Clearly a big move in real yields as well yesterday, but at these levels, we think the tips are actually pretty attractive. Break evens look roughly 15 basis points too narrow versus our fair value framework. Tips offer very positive carry over the next couple of months. And we think that tips offer, again, a sort of better sort of risk reward proposition here, given that the primary risk to our Fed call is a stickier inflation profile.
Thanks, Phoebe. You know, one of the things you often write about, Phoebe, is this connection between break-even and commodities. And of course, we've had this big rally in oil prices, maybe something like 25% off the trough. And, you know, just love to hear how you see break-evens from the perspective of commodities, and also maybe expand a little bit about your view on break-evens and real yields. Is one of the interesting things that you wrote recently about was the asymmetry in the risks. This idea that, you know, it is a bit different this time in the sense that, you know, if you look at the history, when we're cutting rates after an inflationary period, we've usually been cutting rates because of growth risk. This time, arguably, we'll be cutting interest rates because of disinflation. So maybe that creates a slightly different dynamic.
Yeah. And I think to that point, you know, I think when we think about break evens here, I think break-evens could be well supported in sort of a variety of scenarios, whether inflation starts to gradually move lower, allowing the Fed to ease, or again, if inflation proves stickier and there is more concern about sort of structural inflation in this environment, and kind of related to that, if commodity prices keep sort of creeping higher here. So to your first question, energy prices sort of have a direct pass-through to TIPS valuations. Energy is roughly 7% of the headline CPI, you know, vast majority of that being motor fuels and other fuels. So a pretty direct pass-through from higher gasoline prices. But we have found in our work that benchmark break-evens have a very strong correlation and sensitivity to not just energy, but broad commodity prices overall. And we've seen that relationship strengthen even in recent years. So in our own fair value framework, we look at benchmark break-evens based on a broad commodity curve index, as well as the front end of the OAS curve as sort of a macro risk proxy. And those two factors alone can explain about 93% of the variation in five-year seasonally adjusted break-evens over the last 7 years. And based on that framework, as I mentioned, break-evens do appear too narrow at these levels. So we think there's a valuation argument to holding tips. I will mention also, though, it's interesting to see sort of break-evens lagging the move in commodity prices to start the year. So our broad commodity curve index is up about 10% since the start of the year. And when you look at inflation swaps or break-evens further out the curve, what we can really see is those longer run forwards have been very well anchored, and we're not really seeing much inflation risk premium getting priced in along the curve. So you look at things like five-year inflation swaps, those are still trading right around 265. That's near the middle of the one-year range. And then even at the very front end of the inflation swap curve, you can look at the fixings, out through this summer. And even after yesterday's print, we're not seeing a ton of repricing there. Markets are still priced for a pretty significant step down in the sequential pace of core CPI inflation. So again, I do think there's value there, but it's notable that there's been this divergence in sort of market performance in inflation space versus commodities.
Thanks, Phoebe. Let's turn to Greg. Greg, taking everything that Phoebe said into account, of course, as you know very well, if you only had one factor to predict gold prices, real yield would probably be right up there, of course. But that model in isolation hasn't worked particularly well, and they've been you've been highlighting other sources of buying, and Hybin wrote about reserve managers buying from China. Is the link between real yields and gold right now broken, or maybe you could tell us about who's been buying gold and kind of what it means for your overall view?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Tom. From my perspective, what we've seen here is we've had a clear deviation since basically the Russia-Ukraine invasion in terms of the real yield versus gold relationship. We have stayed very much much more supported in terms of gold prices than what would be implied over the Fed rate hiking cycle. Now, recently, if we look at gold sort of 15% jump from the beginning of March, we've had a total dislocation. From that perspective, it is, as we've been pricing out the Fed and seeing higher real yields, that is at the exact time that we've kind of broken higher above, 2100 and now reaching 2350. So we're clearly not taking our cues at the moment from real yields. So what is really driving us here? Well, I think the first leg higher from sort of just above 2000 to just below 2200 in gold was in our view a pretty clear sort of technical break followed through by momentum and momentum trading in CTAs. And we can see that in terms of the jump in aggregate open interest in COMEX gold futures, as well as the shifts higher in net managed money positioning, which have gone towards 2-year highs. Where it becomes a little bit more confusing is that break higher from sort of 2180 into up towards 2350. That's happened in April. We haven't seen that same follow through in terms of aggregate open interest. Now, what is interesting over this is there's a lot of people searching for one smoking gun. We don't think it's really there, right? We're not seeing a massive amount of physical buying at the moment. Yes, central banks are still there, but their pace has sort of been diminished by some of the higher pricing. Chinese demand, if we look at Shanghai premiums, is still relatively okay, but it's not screaming that China's demanding every single ounce. The most notable thing actually is that we're not seeing any physical selling into this very sharp rally, which is what we would definitely expect, particularly from Asian physical holders. So those who have gold are not really selling into this rally. And I think that's created a bit of an illiquid vacuum type environment that has really sort of pushed us higher up towards these lofty heights. Now, when we look forward, I think that's insightful because what's even beyond gold in terms of driving real yields is the structural trends, right? There's a reason that central banks have begun buying over 1,000 tons of gold in 22 and 23, more than double their pace in the previous years. And that's because we're seeing fraying geopolitics. We're also seeing, rethinks on reserve asset allocation, given forward-looking budget deficits, and also the potential trigger of, as Phoebe was talking about, three back-to-back CPI beats. So that kind of inflationary dynamic, as well as this geopolitical environment, is something that I think we cannot discount, and in our view is sort of leading to some of the physical holders that we thought would deliver into this rally really holding back and pushing gold prices even higher.
You know, Greg, that explanation makes a lot of sense, because of course that buying from the reserve managers took place around in the past 2 years or so. Haibin had some stats on buying from China. It was since fall of 22, November 22, that he saw, 10 million ounces of buying from China, from the PBOC stats. But if you look at the rally, it's been, just the last few months of the year. So seeing the net length of the CTAs as an explanation makes a lot more sense with the price action. But one of the things we love to talk about, and part of the reason we are long ourselves in our asset allocation, this is part of the asset allocation that's worked well, is being long oil, long gold, is this idea that when you get to the cutting stage of the rate cycle, that gold tends to rally around 10%. So given that we're maybe above fair value right now, and allowing for the possibility that some rate cuts disappear, and so maybe the macro backdrop is not as favorable from that respect, but maybe geopolitical risk is, a help for gold. How are you viewing the rate cutting period for gold?
Yeah, I think from our perspective, along with you, we've been structurally bullish on gold since essentially the late 2022, and we reiterated it in our 2024 year had outlook just at the beginning of this year. And from when we look forward, essentially, what we do think is there is an asymmetry when the Fed begins cutting, in that gold does seem to snap back into a bullish pattern in terms of following real yields. So while we're sort of dislocated now, we're pretty long in positioning. I do think there is risk of mean reversion in the near term if we begin to bleed some of this length. When we look forward, we still remain structurally bullish for a lot of those reasons I was talking: central banks buying, reserve asset diversification, retail demand in China. These things we don't think are going away. As we look forward, geopolitics continue to look strained. And then from my perspective, when it comes, Fed cutting, even if it's somewhat later or diminished than what we're expecting, is still something that we think is going to deliver further upside. And in particular, the one area that we haven't seen any sort of buying is in physical ETF allocations. Those have actually remained, were falling in the beginning of this year, have sort of begun to bottom out. But when we look forward, what we anticipate under a falling yield environment is that the attractiveness of parking cash for retail investors in money markets funds begins to fall. And that then can kind of shift a reallocation back into physical retail ETF holdings, which we think will be a powerful feed through in gold prices as we go forward. So yes, it's maybe not as bullish as we were anticipating with, over 100 basis points of Fed cuts, but we still think that once we get in that, it's adding sort of another dimensional layer to this structural bull case that keeps us supportive of the metal.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Phoebe, for joining us, and thank you all for listening to At Any Rate. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co., all rights reserved. This episode recorded on April 11th, 2024.